today on Against the Grain. What do you get when you let a radical historian loose in San Francisco? Chris Carlson, who's been digging up alternative histories of the city by the bay for a quarter century, has got a new book out, and its title says it all. Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories. I'm CS. Chris Carlson will regale you with more than a few amazing but true stories about race, class, urban development, and the environment coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It ain't no conventional history. In fact, Chris Carlson might be constitutionally incapable of writing something conventional. He's interested in the radical, the offbeat, the overlooked, the forgotten. And there's an abundance of that to be found in the object of his studies, the city of San Francisco, with its turbulent history, its contradictions, its incredibly varied cast of characters. So much that's trend-setting and groundbreaking has emerged from San Francisco and its denizens, and you can find stories galore in Carlson's new book, Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories. Chris Carlson is an historian, photographer, and occasional college professor. He conducts award-winning, history-themed bicycle and walking tours of San Francisco, and he's co-founder and co-director of Shaping San Francisco, a participatory community history project. When Chris joined me the other day, I asked him why San Francisco has been so attractive over the years to rebels, outcasts, contrarians, and misfits.
One of the reasons I think people have come here who have sort of outsider perspectives is it for a long time was outside. It really was very far away from everywhere, certainly at the point of origin as a urban space, as a modern urban space of the 19th century. You had to go a long, long way to get to San Francisco, either by sailing ship around the Horn of South America or across the Panamanian Isthmus, and by steamship or sailing ship up the coast to get here. Or some arduous overland journey, you know, the famous covered wagons that made the Oregon Trail and the other journeys across the vast expanses of the middle of North America. So it wasn't easy to get here, and it wasn't, you know, something you did lightly. And you mostly did it because you were ready to leave behind the world that you had been in, either to reinvent yourself entrepreneurially for some characters, and very often just, you know, spiritually and politically and psychologically. For a lot of people, it was a place to come to where you had a fresh start. So, you know, people came here who were refugees from the 1848 revolutions in Europe. Later, even some communards came from the Paris Commune. Different kinds of radicals and other kinds of folks would show up, you know, from the East Coast in various capacities. Obviously, a certain number of gay men arrived here as what was known at the time as remittance men, because they were given remittances to get as far away from their families as possible. And once you got here, you really did have the chance to sort of invent yourself on any basis that you wanted. For some people, it meant inventing fake military pasts and becoming colonels or generals or what have you. And for other people, it was more about just really starting on a new foot, leaving behind debts, leaving behind broken relationships and marriages, children. I mean, not always admirable what people left behind, but nevertheless, they did. And it was just a kind of at the edge of the continent, at the edge of the known world, the edge of the civilized world, certainly the edge of the white world. And it was very much of a white enterprise for the most part at that time, right from the very beginnings.
So back briefly to these remittances men. So the families would literally pay their gay offspring to get as far away as possible from them, from their families?
That's what I've heard from Harry Hay, who's passed away now, was, you know, one of the founders of the Mattachine Society, and not so long ago was the Grand Marshal of the Gay Pride Parade here in San Francisco. And so Harry is telling the story about, you know, the earliest arrivals of what were not yet gay men, because people didn't really have that expression yet. They didn't really have a term for it. Even all the way up until the 1930s, it was quite unusual to have any kind of coherent identitarian expression, because homosexuality wasn't considered a way of being so much as a series of acts, and many people engaged in those acts who didn't necessarily don an identity from it, which is still true to this day, actually. But back in that era, you know, even like Hazita says it in the 1930s, you know, on a good day, somebody who was in the gay community might characterize themselves as temperamental. That was a good way of describing who they were. And so the remittance men were, you know, earlier iteration of that in the 1850s, who were essentially, and maybe in the 1860s and 70s as well, men who were clearly gay, who liked men, or sometimes women who liked women, but mostly they weren't getting the same kind of financial resources that men were in that era. And the men were sent away, sent as far away as they could go, away from polite society, and often end up in San Francisco. And of course, that ended up essentially fueling the development of an underground, a noirish underground in San Francisco that was both transgressive sexually as well as transgressive in other capacities as well, politically and otherwise.
Prior to emancipation, were people who escaped their enslaved status in slave states and came to California, were they safe once they got here?
Definitely not. Slavery was in California right from the get-go, and people have really mischaracterized that until quite recently. We're starting to have some new histories appearing that are substantially laying that myth to rest. California, of course, was admitted to the Union in 1850 as a free state, quote-unquote. But part of that agreement, the 1850 Compromise, was to enforce the fugitive slave laws. And so that meant that anybody who arrived here as an escaped slave was already a criminal, because basically stealing yourself was stealing property, and if you know, got up and left, that's essentially was an act of property theft, and so you were already criminalized and subject to being captured and sent back. People who arrived here as slaves, on the other hand, found themselves in this ambiguous state, because they hadn't broken any laws, they had traveled with their quote-unquote owners across the United States, across what was then mostly not yet state territories. They had not tried to escape en route. They remained under the control of their owners. But once they got to California, they would meet other free black folks who would tell them, hey, this is a free state. You know, after 18 months, you're legally free here in California. And so more and more people began to just get up and go. And since you couldn't be enslaved in California under the official terms of the state's admission, if you broke the contract, that is to say, if you freed yourself from your status as property while in California, you weren't breaking any laws, because there was no law that said you could be held as a slave in California. So those folks were often captured and sent back into slavery anyway by the early courts in California. There was a whole lot of cases up through about 1855, 56, in San Francisco's courts and in courts in Sacramento, where owners claimed their slave properties and had them returned to them. People who had gone off and married somebody, and man and women, either one, and moved to some farm in Sonoma County, or, you know, out in the Central Valley or up in the foothills doing their own gold mine effort or whatever it might be. And if the owner could identify where they were and show that he had papers owning that person, then very often the courts of California, which were of course entirely white and white judges, would return that person to slavery, and very often even had them sent back to the South. So we don't know how many, because nobody was doing the proper documentation of all that at the time, but there were definitely in the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were maintained in slavery in California, working for their owners, oftentimes put out as wage laborers into you know, various types of enterprises in Sacramento, whether it would be mining enterprises or warehouse or ship or whatever, and then the wages that they earned would be given to the owners, not to them. They might get a small amount of it, but generally they were not working for wages.
There's a person in your book named Archie Lee. Why did he come to California from Mississippi? And why did he eventually visit or stay at the home of a woman named Mary Ellen Pleasant in San Francisco?
Yeah, Mary Ellen Pleasant, actually. Yeah, she amazing character. She ends up really embodying the western terminus of the Underground Railroad. But Archie Lee's a character who became quite famous in San Francisco and California history in the 1850s. Just prior to the Dred Scott decision of 1857, Archie Lee was a man who had been enslaved as he arrived. He traveled with his owner from Mississippi all the way to California without escaping. He had never tried to escape while he was in Mississippi. But once in California, and once he was working with other black folks for the most part in various capacities, they convinced him that he should free himself. And so he did. Yeah, I don't think it took a lot of convincing, really. And so he ran away and became a free man for a little while. And then he was captured by fugitive slave hunters and brought into custody. And then a series of trials took place in which different judges were confronted by lawyers who were working on behalf of the abolitionist movement, saying that Archie Lee did not break any laws because he merely stopped being a slave in California, which is not illegal. It's actually under the law. You could not be held as a slave in California officially. Different judges made different decisions, and a couple of judges were returning him as slave property to the owner, and the owner was trying to transport him into San Francisco to ultimately put him on a vessel to get him out of California altogether. And there was a moment where he was coming down the river and into the bay with two sheriff's deputies holding him, and there was people trying to find him, and there was actually mobs of free blacks wandering up and down the waterfront of San Francisco trying to figure out if Archie Lee was on any of the boats coming and going from the waterfront at the time. And somebody realized that he was on a boat that was out in the bay, and they went out there and seized him and got him and brought him into town and freed him from custody. And then he had another hearing in San Francisco where the judge actually did set him free and remanded him from the courtroom into the custody of who was paying his bond, which was Mary Ellen Pleasant. And Mary Ellen Pleasant was a black woman herself who had been an abolitionist and grown up in Nantucket off of Massachusetts, and made her way through New Orleans to San Francisco in 1851, and happened to arrive with a good deal of money. She had $15,000 cash, which was an enormous amount of money then. And she had that money because her husband, who had died, had left her with that money. And she was a mixed-race woman herself. It's a little bit unknown for sure whether she was born into slavery or born as a free woman, but she certainly made herself a free woman. And she escaped from the East and made her way to San Francisco. And on the ship that she came with was a guy named Thomas Bell, who became her banker, a white guy. And what happened is that she was a very shrewd businesswoman, and she had bought and sold and invested in properties, and would meet every arriving ship at the foot of the piers. And as either anybody black would come off the boat, or beautiful young women, as the case may be, she would greet them and offer them opportunities. In case of the arriving black folks, she'd say, "Come with me, I can give you a place to stay, I can feed you, and I can even find you work." And most of the work she found were as maids and butlers in the wealthy homes of San Francisco for these folks. And they became her ears and eyes on the city's elite. And so from that insider knowledge, she was able to shrewdly buy and sell properties and businesses and various things. And she became quite wealthy, to the point that after she had helped save Archie Lee and gave him enough money to send him on his way, she was able to return to Chatham, Ontario, in a meeting with Frederick Douglass and John Brown, and give John Brown $30,000 cash to help stage the Harper's Ferry raid. And Harper's Ferry, of course, famously the opening shots of the Civil War by some accounts, was the state-of-the-art military arsenal in the United States at the time. So it's kind of like seizing, you know, a state-of-the-art nuclear base or something in this era. And later she's finally, she dies, and she's buried in Napa, where her headstone was, at her request, says one thing, says she was a friend of John Brown.
Hmm. Chris Carlson joins me. He is a writer, a San Francisco historian, tour guide. His new book is Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Many more stories and adventures to elicit from you this hour, but I want to ask you about the book as a whole, Hidden San Francisco. What is the theme, or what are the themes of this book?
Well, there's four major chapters in the book covering ecology, ecological history, labor history, transit history, and then broadly understood dissent, you know, revolutions, riots, you know, radical opposition of various types, sometimes literary, sometimes in the streets. And so those four themes then are all themes that arose from the work that I've been doing for the last 25 years with a project called Shaping San Francisco. And Shaping San Francisco has a digital archive. And my personal interest, which arose from partly from the fact that I'd already been deeply involved in ecological activism since the 70s when I was a young man, and labor history, because I was one of the publishers of Processed World magazine back in the day and did a lot of writing and thinking about sort of the stupidity of modern work and how much different it could be, and what kinds of ways we have leverage at work that we don't use adequately, but it is sort of the core of a radical opposition to the world as we know it, is our ability to stop production and start making the world we want to live in. So labor and ecology were always my kind of key themes of interest, and particularly because both of those two themes are so important, and yet for most people involved in either labor history or for the new field of ecological history, they rarely refer to each other. It just seems like such an obvious and glaring omission to talk about ecology without talking about the work we do that makes the mess that we're trying to supposedly clean up with writing checks on Sunday out of our liberal checkbooks. Or in the case of labor history, you know, there tends to be this glorification of the unions and strikes, and that's all to the good to understand all those histories better. But, you know, the dark history of labor in San Francisco is how racist it always was, up till even quite recently. And not to mention the fact that, you know, the mess it's made, the labor, the work that was done, and the lack of sort of critical engagement with deciding who's doing the work, how it's being done, and what's being done, which I think is an abdication of the labor movement going back to the 19th century, should have been integrated into a proper understanding of what's happening with the ecology of the area. So the ecology movements tended to emerge from outside of the labor movement, and even oftentimes opposed by the labor movement, which to me is just head-scratchingly strange. I don't get it. So those are a couple of the key themes that I think are really important. And there's a few other binaries that I developed thinking about this book that can't be ignored. You cannot even begin to discuss San Francisco or sort of the foundation of the city without discussing genocide and slavery. And we've touched on slavery already. There's more to say about it, quite a bit more. It wasn't only African Americans who were enslaved in California. Obviously, you know, the native Californians were, and they had already been by the mission system to a great extent under Spanish colonialism and then Mexican control. But when the Americans came in, and as Benjamin Madley's amazing book, American Genocide, The California Indian Tragedy, demonstrates, you know, by going through case by case every single incident of violence between whites and Indians, which are almost always one-sided by whites on Indians, from 1846 to 1873, he actually makes an overwhelming case for this systematic genocide that was carried out by white America against California Indians. And it wasn't successful in the sense that we still have a fairly vibrant native California that's been re-emergent and making itself heard more and more, thank goodness. And here we are right in the Bay Area on unceded territory of Ohlone peoples of various tribes that existed here for thousands of years before any white folks showed up. So genocide has to be at the heart of our inquiry into local history because it still informs the world we're in. And then slavery, which includes the African-American slavery and then Indian slavery, which built this place to a great extent, couldn't have existed without it. It also should include the slavery or you know, quasi-slavery, I guess would be the best way to put it, of the conditions of this cutting edge of the labor force at the time, which were the sailors, the people on ships, who had zero rights. In fact, all through the 19th century, you know, there's famously so many stories of these sadistic bucko mates who would, you know, first mates who just would be so crazy beating the sailors to within an inch of their lives. I mean, there's even accounts, you know, by captains in their drunken storytelling in bars later that get put into books where they say, oh, I didn't ever think I was really at sea until there was blood running in the scuppers, you know, and so it's just this kind of mentality that existed. And the truth is that in 1897, the United States Supreme Court held that sailors were exempt from the 13th Amendment's ban on slavery, on involuntary servitude, because they were considered to be deficient in the full capacity of a normal adult and had to be treated as minors, like the captain was their father. And that was held by the United States Supreme Court 3 years before the 20th century. It's incredible. But that means that they were held in slavery. So we have to think back on that whole era of the building of the so-called pioneer period and the glorious building of California that so much, you know, kind of gets overstated over and over again. Well, yeah, that building happened, but it couldn't have happened without coerced and enslaved labor. That was a key part of it.
There's so much in what you just said. I want to return to something about the slavery of Native Americans. You write that in its first years as a state, the California legislature passed laws allowing for the legal custodianship and indenture of Indians in California. What did that mean in effect?
In effect, it meant that white vigilantes, self-appointed militias, were the sort of way to gloss over what they were doing. But these were just essentially barbarians in gangs roaming around Northern California for the most part, although to some extent in Southern California too, would come upon villages of, you know, 50 to several hundred Indians and just slaughter them. And anybody left over from that, they would claim were vagrants. And what they were especially able to do was to seize the children. And children were sold into slavery routinely throughout the 1850s in California, where these white marauders would come through, kill the parents, kill the adults in the area, and then take all the children up and sell them into wardship or slave, you know, virtual slave conditions. And it, according to Benjamin Madley's work, he's documented that 25% of all the households in Northern California in the 1850s had a slave Indian child in the house. And this worked not only with Indian children, but also black children. So all the African Americans who arrived here in the early part of California's history, many of whom arrived as slaves, but not all of whom remained as such, nevertheless, it was very easy for whites to go and take children and go to a white judge where they would not accept any testimony from anybody but white men, and say that they had found these children being mistreated or inadequately housed or fed or whatever you might have said at the time, and that these children had to be saved by being made wards of some local land baron or local property owner or businessman or what have you. And the judge would dutifully say, yes, you're correct. Oh, that's all for the children's benefit to be made a ward of so-and-so local esteemed businessman. And now that poor child is a slave of that guy. And those children were essentially vanished from the records as slaves because they were wards. And in a patriarchal society, that's just considered somehow beneficial to the receiver of that role, as opposed to having their labor stolen as children by these venal characters. So that process then was codified in the California law by the state legislature in 1850 and renewed again in 1860, furthering their ability to seize any wandering Indian and claiming it, that person was a vagrant. And for their own good and for the state's good, that person should be put to work by a local business. And so they would be then quickly brought in as, you know, essentially indentured labor, where they had no right to leave. They were treated, you know, they were given food and, you know, room and board of some sort, although the conditions were pretty squalid, to say the least. And that was the way it was right up into the Civil War. And it was when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by Abraham Lincoln in 1863, within weeks of that, the California legislature, under pressure from the rather famously not intelligent Leland Stanford, who was the governor at the time, at least knew that they had to change the laws in California, so they deleted the laws that allowed for the indefinite indentured holding of Indian laborers, Indian humans, from that time on. But until that happened in 1863, slavery was essentially unchecked in California for Indians.
Chris Carlson is his name. We are talking about his new book, Hidden San Francisco. He conducts award-winning bicycle and walking tours of San Francisco, and he is co-founder and co-director of Shaping San Francisco. His other books include Nowtopia and a novel called After the Deluge. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. The poet and critic Kenneth Rexroth, he moved to San Francisco in 1927. Tell us a bit about his political and literary activities.
Kenneth Rexroth is a really interesting character because he came out of Chicago right before World War I, and he was an autodidact that taught himself Greek and Latin had been hanging out with Bohemians in that period of high level of radicalism with the IWW and anarchism and feminism riding high all right before the crackdown by the federal government at the end of World War I. But he ended up becoming quite interested in, he was also very interested in nature, and he ended up going to Seattle and hiking down the mountains, down the Pacific Crest all the way till he got to outside of across from San Francisco, and then came over here in 1927 thinking, well, it's a sleepy little town, I can settle there for a little while and see what's happening. And soon found himself sort of in the whirlwind here in the middle of a lot of radical activities. And when the general strike emerged in 1934, that was a larger moment of radical opposition in general in society, and there were the radical artists who were living in the Montgomery Block and had been influenced and sometimes collaborated with Diego Rivera, and there was Rexroth right in the middle of it, helping organize their union of writers and artists and demanding work from the federal government, which led to the murals in Coit Tower. Later, he's part of the group that opposes Japanese internment. He's very much part of the sort of pacifist movement that leads to KPFA after World War II, the conscientious objectors that were refusing to fight in World War II. He was had a regular hour-long radio show. You can hear it all in the Pacifica archives, I know. And then he also wrote a column for many years for the Examiner, San Francisco Examiner, just a little bit odd to imagine that he did. But thanks to the work of Ken Nabb, a longtime Berkeley denizen and fantastic theoretical translator and writer of The Situationists and many other things, he's a big Rexroth fan, and he's been working hard for many years to get the entire body of work of Rexroth available to the public through his Bureau of Public Secrets website. So you can really dive in there. But Rexroth, he was at the heart of the libertarian circle in the 30s and 40s, where people would come together in his Scott Street apartment and share writings and debates and discussion. And Rexroth was kind of holding the space for people, you know, and that's a really vital role. I feel like he was a thread that knit together the radicalism of the teens, the pre-World War I teens, to the radicalism of the 60s, because the folks in the, you know, various upheavals of the 60s, from the anti-HUAC hearings in 1960 through the student movements and the anti-Vietnam War movements, they rediscovered Rexroth during that time, and Rexroth was able to bring that historical knowledge of the kinds of radicalism that preceded them into the discussion to a great extent. So that's a vital role. In some ways, our history project tries to play a similar role in this era.
Speaking of the 1960s upheavals, I mean, much of that will be familiar to Bay Area denizens and well beyond. One thing that might kind of be forgotten and therefore fit nicely again within this book, Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories, written by my guest Chris Carlson, is the Hunters Point Uprising. Hunters Point being a neighborhood in San Francisco on September 27th, 1966, a white police officer shot and killed a 17-year-old African-American teen named Matthew Johnson Jr. as he fled the scene of a stolen car. What kind of turbulence followed?
Well, that led to a fair amount of street fighting. The kids all showed up. Everybody's very angry. And of course, at that point, the San Francisco Police Department had a long history of its own white racism and prevailing pretty much to the present, unfortunately. But at that point, they had often sort of pursued a policy of herding young black folks up the hill onto Hunters Point. And that, they tried to do that again in this moment, but people kept coming down and they took over 3rd Street and they were throwing rocks and bottles and things like that. And the police showed up and actually surrounded the community center and just filled it with hundreds of bullets, and thinking that they were being shot at. They never found anybody inside that was shooting at them. There were some kids up in the second floor just huddled on the floor when they finally went in there, who had no weapons at all. There was quite a lot of that kind of very violent confrontations for the following days between the police and rioters, the folks who were uprising against this ongoing abuse by police violence, to the point that the city was so freaked out, they were calling the mayor and various other folks to come down and meet with the people at the Bayview Opera House. When they arrived, the chief of police and the mayor were pelted with tomatoes and rotten vegetables. And then the governor, Jerry Brown's dad, Pat Brown, was the governor at the time, and he actually was convinced to call out the National Guard and invoke martial law. So this is really forgotten in San Francisco's history. We had occupation of 3 neighborhoods by martial law inspired National Guard troops who were essentially young men, 18, 19 years old, with, you know, driving around with Jeeps and machine guns and live ammunition on the back, through Hunters Point, Bayview area, through the Fillmore, and through the Haight-Ashbury at the time. All 3 neighborhoods were put under curfew. At 8 p.m. you had to be indoors and could be shot if you were out. So it was pretty intense, a pretty wild time. And it was, right after that moment, because of the curfew and because of that kind of intensity of the state violence, that's when the Diggers appeared. Suddenly you start seeing flyers all over the neighborhood in October 66, which are the very earliest manifestation of the Diggers, who are sort of this amazing group of radicals, some of whom broke away from the Mine Troop and others who just joined up with them, and really kind of gave us the deep ethic of everything should be free.
Chris Carlson is his name, writer, San Francisco historian, photographer, occasional college professor, historian. He wears a lot of hats. His new book is Hidden San Francisco. We'll take a short break and speak more with Chris about his book. And believe me, we're just scratching the surface, folks. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Chris Carlson, he's written a number of books, including Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today, and After the Deluge, a novel. His new book is Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories. It's just out from Pluto Press. So you mentioned the San Francisco Diggers. They made their appearance in San Francisco in 1966. Tell us more about this emphasis that the Diggers had on free stuff, free food and free things.
Yeah, they basically were, you know, people who were coming to grips with the fact that the banality of American life was so much bound up in the buying and selling of every little thing and commodification of every aspect of our lives, including our own labor. And so they saw, you know, the chance in the mid-60s, as many people did, you know, with the incredible wealth of the society at the time, that there should be a way to stop working so hard and start enjoying life more. And so they just said, why would we wait? Why are we going to, like, wait for somebody to propose something? Let's just start living the world we want to be in. And so they did. And one of the ways they did that was to create a series of free stores. They had two or three free stores in the area, in the Lower Haight and at that point known as, it was part of the Fillmore District, and in the Haight-Ashbury. And basically anything that they could get, whether they gleaned it from people's homes or found it or however they got it, sometimes there were probably some shoplifting going on to help supplement the supplies. They would just fill the stores up, and you'd go into the store and just help yourself. They even had bowls of money in some moments. And so people, there's funny stories of people coming in, you know, kind of surreptitiously sticking things under their jackets. And then one of the diggers people there walks up to this woman and says, you know, you can't steal here. And she's all kind of resentful. What do you mean? I'm not stealing. No, you can't steal here. There's nothing to steal. Everything is yours already. Take whatever you want. And she was so taken aback by this whole experience, she comes back the next day with a tray of cupcakes and gives them away to everybody. So that, you know, it's a kind of a magic thing when you do stuff for free, when you engage in the gift economy. People don't realize how important that is to sort of shatter one's expectations of how we interact with each other and with our material lives. They understood that, and they were the first ones to really push it in a really important ways. And so they staged the Death of Money March up Haight Street with a whole a coffin full of cash and other things, and they set it on fire in the panhandle and danced around it. And then a year later, when the Summer of Love had pretty much come and gone, and they knew the Summer of Love was a marketing hype by the mass media, and they were kind of freaked out by it because they realized, oh my God, you know, tens of thousands of kids are just going to show up here. We don't have any resources to do this. We've got to get ready. And they worked really hard, and that's when the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic was started by other people, but in part inspired by their arguments that they were making on flyers that were posting all over the neighborhood. They were giving away free food every day in the panhandle, and that was one of the things, when you think about our sort of today's appreciation for food, that we like to eat well and have organic food and all this kind of stuff, where does that come from? Well, these radical moments in the mid-60s and beyond is really the heart of it, and there's two pieces of it. One is the kind of stuff on the ground in San Francisco, so the diggers are going to the farmer's market down in Alamany or going to local supermarkets and saying, what are you throwing away? We'll take it. And they'd take it and they would produce giant vats of soup and other kinds of bread and food and whatnot. And they'd take it every day to the panhandle right near Ashbury and Oak. And they would have this huge vat of free soup. And essentially Food Not Bombs, most people are probably familiar with today, they get their ideas completely from this. So these guys are giving away free food, and they're also holding up a 12-foot 2x4 frame painted bright yellow. And as the drivers on Oak Street go by, they're looking through this big square frame, and they're seeing people handing each other free food. And so they call that the free frame of reference. And then they gave out to all the people getting free food little 2-inch squares, wooden squares, that they could hold up to their eye and look through them. So whenever they wanted to change their frame of reference, they could just hold up these little squares. So they're very clever and very funny, and they actually really did galvanize people to start thinking about organics and food, and many of them went on to start to, for several of the key players ended up founding the Planet Drum Foundation, which is still going to this day, and in coining the terms, getting into our consciousness the ideas of bioregionalism, and quite a lot of the ecological activism of the late 70s and 80s you can trace to a number of the folks associated with the Diggers. They also helped the Black Panthers. They brought all this free food to the Panthers, and then months later, the Panthers started their free breakfast program. I wouldn't argue that they did it because of the Diggers, but it certainly didn't hurt that they got these free food deliveries from the Diggers, and it probably helped inspire them to realize how useful free food distribution would be as a political act.
Let me ask you about the freeway revolt. So there was a conflict over changes, proposed changes to San Francisco's transportation infrastructure from the late 1950s to 1966. It's called the Freeway Revolt. What's important to know about this?
Well, the Freeway Revolt is one of the key social movements on whose shoulders we stand today, along with the anti-nuclear movement and the Save the Bay movement. Those all came around in the same period, late 50s, early 60s. And without them, the Bay Area would be much worse, and certainly the city of San Francisco would be a much worse place to live than it is today. I mean, if the freeway revolt hadn't succeeded, we would see the entire bay rimmed with a double-decker freeway. You wouldn't even see the bay. The Mission District where I live, the Valencia and Guerrero streets would have been turned into a Mission freeway. You would have had a freeway cutting through Glen Canyon and going out to Golden Gate Park. The Panhandle would have been destroyed, and you would have had a freeway there. It's just a madness. It's a complete madness of, you know, these basically white men in little thin ties with slide rules who think they can engineer the world to be more efficient by building more and more highways, because that was the mentality of the 50s and 60s. And what did they run into? They run into a whole dynamic series of grassroots movements that were primarily driven by middle-class women who had time at that point. They were mostly living in families with single breadwinners. Dad went to work, mom was at home with the kids, they'd go out to the park, and they'd get wind of the fact that their park was slated to have a freeway driven through it, in the case of Glen Canyon and the so-called Gumtree Girls, three women who organized their neighborhood to oppose that. Sue Bierman, who later becomes a supervisor in San Francisco politics and on the Planning Commission and was quite well known as a, you know, key player in the Democratic Party here for many years, and now has a park named after her right at where Clay and Washington off on and off ramps used to be. She was one of the major movers in creating the Haight-Ashbury Neighborhood Council and founding that whole movement. They actually ended up having 70,000 people sign petitions during the late 50s and early 60s. And then got the Board of Supervisors to kill off, I think it was 17 of 20 legs of pieces of freeway that were supposed to be built by the highway planners. And it was a shockwave going across the United States because a city had said no to freeways. It was just unheard of at that time. Nobody else had done it. And after that, many other cities did the same, New Orleans and New York and Portland and various other places. But San Francisco's was the first freeway revolt that succeeded.
Chris Carlson, my guest. And in your new book, Hidden San Francisco, Chris, you also bring up, and you bring up a dizzying array of super interesting things, the eucalyptus wood rush of 1904 to 1914. What was that?
Well, we're kind of living with the results of it still to this day, because our hills, especially in the East Bay, are covered in eucalyptus trees, these blue gum eucalyptus trees. Eucalyptus was originally imported, and Jared Farmer's book, The Trees in Paradise, is a really great place to read a good account of all this, too. But I got some of this story about the wood rush from Harold Gilliam, a longtime San Francisco Chronicle writer, environmental journalist. In 1904, there was this claim that California was suffering from a hardwood crisis. Of course, this was after decades of massive clear cutting and timbering of all the old ancient forests of California. So there was a lot of wood had disappeared by then, but it was a long way from being a crisis. Nevertheless, in the typical way of, you know, hucksters then and now, people invent crises that must be solved by you buying a product. And in this case, the hucksters were saying, look, you could solve the hardwood crisis and get rich quick. And here's how you do it. You send us $5 for this little tray of seedlings, and you can plant them in an acre of land that we'll include at no extra charge for your $5 down near the Mojave Desert. And you will be able to plant your eucalyptus trees, and they will grow, they're the fastest growing trees in the world, and they will solve California's hardwood crisis, and you will live off the proceeds, and your children and your children's children, and for decades to come, you're going to be wealthy. And so lots of people bought into that for $5, and, you know, some people actually established, you know, giant eucalyptus tree plantations. For instance, there was 30,000 trees growing along Telegraph Avenue in Oakland at a certain point. And it took about 10 years, but by 1914, after there'd been a lot of discussion about, you know, what can you do with these trees that are coming? Are they actually any good for lumber? Then the Department of Forestry, under the that is, you know, part of the Interior Department of the federal government, came out with a definitive study that said, well, sorry, folks, that blue gum eucalyptus tree is pretty much useless as timber. It's far too brittle and full of oil and doesn't work very well for lumbering. And doesn't really have any good commercial applications at all, other than perhaps lozenges and some certain amount of oils and ointments. So too bad. And so everybody just abandoned their plantations, and the trees, unfortunately, were quite suited to the California environment. They come from Australia, where there's actually 260 varieties or more of eucalyptus trees, many of which are more suitable for proper timber and hardwood, but they take a lot longer to grow. And the blue gum grows really fast, as we know. And so it also creates very alkaline conditions at the base, so the relationship it has to native plants is not healthy at all. It tends to supplant native plants and native trees and other things. So you have these eucalyptus forests everywhere, you know, on the East Bay Hills. They took it down in Angel Island, but we still have a giant one up in Sutro Forest here in San Francisco that are... One, you know, advantage some people like to say is that they do provide habitat, and in the case of the ones near the fog belt, they do catch fog and have fog drip. So there's some of those ecological features that do come with them. But to a great extent, they're senescent, they're very old, and the trees are reaching the end of their lifespan, and they're fire traps. And as we know from the 1991 Oakland Hills fire, you know, these things are just waiting to blow up on us again. So the long history of the eucalyptus tree is an ambivalent one at best, because there are people who really like it and see it as an emblem of California, and that goes back to when it was first brought here in the 1870s by horticulturists who just used it for windbreaks and ornamentation. But by the time it got into the sort of industrialized and exaggerated development process of the wood rush of the first decade of the 20th century, it really went awry, and we've been living with the skewed results of it ever since.
Chris Carlson, he is elucidating a lot of interesting details about San Francisco history and the Bay Area and drawing connections. And he does that very well as a San Francisco historian with his tour guides and with his new book, Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories. I'm C.S. Song. You are listening to Against the Grain. And Chris, you helped co-found Critical Mass in 1992. Many people know that Critical Mass is a form of bicyclist solidarity in which cyclists hit the road in large numbers. What can you share with us in the brief time we have remaining about, and this is such a big question, but bike politics in San Francisco?
Well, you know, Critical Mass starts in 1992, and it emerges from the anti-war, anti-nuclear kind of young anarchist milieus of the time, the 1980s and even earlier, and takes advantage of a lot of those different kinds of influences to sort of suddenly have a mass seizure of the streets. Well, every month we just would get out there, and they started with just, 50 people on the first one in September of 92, but it grew super fast, and it just grew by word of mouth, and originally by snail mail and telephone calls, and then after another year and a half or so, the internet was starting to be part of people's lives to a greater extent, 93, 94 period, and it really took off and spread all over the world, and it's still going in many places. So the bicycling movement as such, you know, depended on that kind of anarchic mass seizure of the streets. You would not have all the infrastructural changes that we've had since then without that. But curiously, one of the things, you know, doing history that we found out, and it was largely thanks to Hank Chapeau's great work on digging up the history of the bicycling movement of 100 years earlier. In 1896, there were mass seizure of the streets by bicyclists. Who knew? And it was actually what became known at the time as the Good Roads Movement. And the Good Roads Movement was demanding, of all things, asphalt and good roads. And they didn't really know that by demanding that, they were going to set the stage for the private car to take over the world, but they did. And that just goes to say that sometimes what you ask for, you better be a little cautious about and think twice about what it might lead to. But it's worth also mentioning that as we kind of cloak ourselves in the very ecologically self-righteous jackets of bicycling, which many people tend to do, it's worth going back and remembering that the bicycle itself is an industrial device. Depends on many of the worst aspects of modern industrialization, and certainly at its point of origin, when it becomes the bike as we know it, with the safety bicycle and the air-filled pneumatic rubber tubes in the 1890s, and that incredible boom of bicycling happens then, that leads to some unbelievable barbarism and slavery throughout the southern Africa area in the Congo and also in the Amazon, where literally millions of people are maimed or murdered by either King Leopold's Belgian military or by self-appointed militarists in Peru and Brazil, who kill people for not bringing in enough rubber, because the only rubber you could get in the 1890s was from trees in tropical climates. And it wasn't until World War II that rubber was fully synthesized from petroleum and was able to be produced in synthetic factories. So for all those years, the bicycling boom in the north led to a boom of rubber extraction in the south, global south, that is. And it was a very dark and horrible story about how badly people were brutalized to produce that, to meet that demand. So the bicycle is certainly a better choice going forward. And, you know, one of the things that I like about what's happened with critical mass and bicycling in San Francisco, like we just had the George Floyd Memorial riot on June 5th, and I went down to it kind of thinking, oh, you know, critical mass has been pretty much dead in the water for a while, and we've had a good 25 plus year run, so I don't feel bad about that. But I didn't expect that many people to show up for the George Floyd Memorial ride, and there's 3,000 bicyclists rolling up Market Street. It's just in our DNA. We know how to seize the streets together on bikes whenever we want to, and I know the East Bay Bike Party had one later that weekend with another 5,000 plus bikes out there. So it's become a very useful tactic in the arsenal of grassroots social movements to be able to mobilize lots of people on bikes, and we sort of taught ourselves how to do that starting in the early 90s, and then slowly but surely found out about all the people who used to do it before us. So glad to know it was deeply rooted in our history, too.
A few minutes left with Chris Carlson. I want to return to the 19th century. A good amount of the corruption and fraud and hypocrisy of elites was written about and exposed by journalists and editors and muckrakers in San Francisco. Tell us about some of the more notable writers mentioned in your book.
Well, it definitely happened quite a bit, and it's one of those things that I was putting together a kind of a long list of these things back when I was working on the chapter about that. I mean, Ambrose Bierce comes to mind as probably one of the more famous ones. You can still buy to this day his Devil's Dictionary, where he makes these hilarious and proper definitions of words. I mean, for example, debt, an ingenious substitute for the chain and whip of the slave driver. Or egotist, a person of low taste, more interested in himself than in me. So, I mean, he was very funny, and he did a lot of kind of exposure of the you know, what was going on in San Francisco and in California at large, but San Francisco was sort of where it was all happening during that era. Publishers of the Wasp, very ambiguous role played by them as well, because it was actually owned by the owner of the Spring Valley Water Company, but the editors quite often were able to do pretty intense exposés of the railroads and the water monopolies and the various things that were going on during that era. There's a bunch of individual characters who are essentially unknown characters, nobody will have heard of them, from the 19th century, who were writers about, you know, some of them who were decrying the treatment of Indians in that period of time. There's a guy, I'm trying to find his name here, oh yeah, J. Ross Brown, who once remarked about Mark Twain, he had made plenty of money on his books and some of it on mine, which is kind of a very classic kind of sense of humor from that period of time. But he was from a, you know, came from an Irish background of, you know, radical Irish folks. And then he quite clearly understood how bad the treatment of California's original inhabitants were. He has a quote that says, "Their history in California is a melancholy record of neglect and cruelty." And it kind of goes on from there. So there's a lot of these guys who are here recognizing how bad it was. And, you know, in the local newspapers, they were calling for the extermination of the Indian population. So it's not too surprising that some of the more dissenting mentalities that were in town were finding another way of thinking about these things. There's a famous poem by Edward Markham in 1899, The Man with the Hoe, that became so popular around the world it was translated into 40 languages. And it was sort of a, you know, peon to the nobility of agricultural labor. So you got quite a bit of that going on throughout the 19th century. And that literary dissenting tradition, which I really learned mostly about from Ferlinghetti and Nancy Peters' great book on the history of literary San Francisco, although there are many other places to get pieces of the story from as well. It's just a through line right to the present. I mean, I kind of think I'm sort of standing on their shoulders and helping advance it to the next people to hand it off to, and there's plenty of them coming up all the time. So I think that part you can pretty much count on is one of the vibrant, you know, aspects of the beating heart of, or the soul of San Francisco that just won't die, which is this just unwillingness to accept the self-congratulatory pabulum that's dished out by the corporate elite and the politicians and all the other people who actually have been running the society for all too long.
Chris Carlson, that's with two S's, San Francisco historian, tour guide, occasional college professor, photographer, and his new book is Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories, Histories and Stories Galore in this book. And it's also studded with places, specific places in San Francisco you can go visit, and you can bring the book along and read about why this intersection or this building has significance in San Francisco history and San Francisco radical history and hidden history. Chris, congratulations on Hidden San Francisco, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I always enjoy your show. It's like one of the few places where people get to really stop and think together. So kudos to you for keeping it going, and let's hope you can keep it going for a long time to come, too.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.